Good morning, everybody. So here we begin Gesundheit, a new year of Torah study. And this year we're going back to Parashat HaShavua after having spent a year on the Haftarot. Now we go back to Parashat HaShavua. And as usual, we start with Parashat Noah. Talking about Parashat Noah, if anybody doesn't have enough from this year and they want to have a classic tape on Parashat Noah, there are some available at the desk on the way out for 15 shekels. You can get a Parashat Noah that was set about 4 or 5 years ago, and I think it's still good today. All right, with the commercial out of the way, Parashat Noah. The part of the parasha that I want to learn with you, chapter 9, pasuk 18. It's after the Mabul. Chapter 9, pasuk 18. And we're going to have to do a little bit of journeying through the Sedra for a few moments. But first, let's see what it's all about. Vayiyu v'nei Noach hayotzim min ha-tevah. The sons of Noach who came out of the Tevah were Shem and Cham and Yafet. V'cham hu avi Kenan. Cham is the father of Kenan. Shlosha Eile, this is after Shishi. Shlosha Eile v'nei Noach, these three were the sons of Noach. And from these the whole world spread out. It begins with these three. The whole world is going to be built by these three. Now, you can either follow me or just trust me when I tell you that that Noach has three children who are Shem, Cham, and Yafet. This is not news to us now. The fact is that we've already been told back in Parshat Bereshit, toward the end of Parshat Bereshit, it says, "Vayehi Noach ben chamesh meot shana." Noach was 500 years old. Vayoled Noach et Shem, et Cham, ve'et Yafet. And Noach gave birth to Shem, Cham, and Yafet. This is in Parshat Bereshit, chapter 5, pasuk 32. So there it said, Noah was 500 years old and he gave birth to Shem, Cham, and Yafet. Okay, so we know that for the first time. When we begin the Sedra itself, the Sedra begins, Eileh told up Noah, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was just Ish Tzadik. He was a righteous man, Tamim, complete, Hayah B'dorotav, in his generation. Et Elokim Hithalech Noah. Noah went with God. Now the second pasuk in the Sedra, Vayoled Noach Shlosha Banim. Noach gave birth to three sons, Et Shem, Et Cham, Ve'et Yafet. Alright? There are two things that happen now in the pasuk. First of all, the pasuk is repeating that he had three sons. In addition to that, the pasuk seems to be telling us something that I don't think we have to be told, that there are three. I would assume that anybody who's told that he had Shem, Cham, and Yafet is capable of figuring out that 1 + 1 + 1 is usually 3. So that means this pasuk at the beginning of the Sedra is doubly difficult. He had three sons, of course it was 3. Shem, Cham, and Yafet, we know it. What's been told to us here? Why is it repeated? Now, the parsha that we're learning, and we're not finished yet, says again, pasuk 18 that we started with, Vayiyu b'nei Noach, the children of Noach, v'yotzim min ha-tevah, v'shem Cham and Yafet. We knew that they were the three who went in, so obviously they're the three who come out. Pasuk 19, the pasuk we just learned, Shlosha Eile b'nei Noach, these three are the sons of Noach. We didn't know it. These three are the sons of Noah. if you just want to jump ahead a few psukim, the first pasuk in chapter 10, Ve'ela toldo b'nei Noach, Shem, Cham, V'yafet. And these are the generations of the children of Noach, Shem, Cham, and Yafet. Nahamol, Nahamol.
Shem,
V'cham, V'yafet. And Et. The point, that's, so I finally got you to the point where you realize that there has to be a reason for it. It will become clearer to us as we go through the parsha, but basically I feel that the first time they are mentioned at the end of Parshat Bereshit, it says that Noah gave birth to Shem, Cham, and Yafet. Doesn't say the number. At the beginning of this sedra, it says there are three children to Noah, Shem, Cham, and Yafet. The purpose of the number three is in order to tell us they're different, they're distinct, they're unique. Each one encompasses within his personality something that is very special to him. And it would seem that these three different types, so to speak, are the ones that will make up all of humanity, and they're the ones who are going to go into the teva with Noach, and they're the ones who are going to come out. What also is going to be fascinating here is, who's the oldest? Who was born first? Who was born second? And who was born third? Now you're going to tell me that Shem is the oldest. Obviously, I wouldn't have asked you the question. If they are listed in the order of their birth, I wouldn't have asked you the question. If I asked you the question, it's obvious that that's not the order. All right. So... There is a pasuk later on. I'll read the pasuk. It's in chapter 10, pasuk 21. Ulashem yulad gamhu, and to Shem were born unto him also. Avi kol b'nei Aver. Shem was the father of all those who came from the other side of the river. Achi Yefet Hakadol. See that pasuk? Achi Yefet Hakadol. The brother of Yefet, the older. Says Rashi, Eini Yodea, when I read the pasuk, I don't know who is described as Hagadol. Is it Yefet who is the oldest, or is it Shem who is the oldest? Eini Yodea, I don't know him, Yefet Hagadol and Shem. Is it Yefet who's the oldest, or Shem? Kishuhu Omer, when it says that Shem was 100 years old, 2 years after the Mabul, heavy Omer, then I must say Yefet Hagadol. Yefet is the oldest. Because Noah was 500 years old when he began to give birth. He married at 500 and began to give birth. V'hamabul haya b'shnot sheish me'ot shana, and the Mabul was in the 600th year of Noah. Nimtza shehagadol v'bonav, the eldest of his sons, therefore, was 100 years old at the time of the Mabul. The Shem lo higi al meyah. Shem did not become 100 years old at shnatayim achar Mabul, until 2 years after the Mabul. Which means, therefore, that the oldest is Yefet, yet he's listed third. The one who comes next would be Cham, and then Shem. In other words, the real order should be Yefet. Now Cham is in the middle, so you know the middle child is always caught in the middle. Yefet, Cham, and Shem. There may be significance to this, so we'll see that in a little while. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch says, and we'll begin with this as an introduction so that it will lead us into what's going to come later. Each one of these three has a different personality. Each one of these three represents something very, very unique and very different. Shame shame, comes from the word, yes, name. What does the idea of name represent? You will recall that in Parshat Bereshit it says that after God created man, Adam, he brought all of the animals before Adam so that Adam should call them names, and he gave them names. Now, what's the significance of his giving them names? It doesn't mean that he called one Harry and one Jack. What he did was he was able to understand and perceive the essential nature of the particular creature, and the name that he gave was, in a sense, that which described what that particular animal is. It means, Kishmo Kainhu, yes, the name represents what the animal is. Giving something a name it can also be described as defining something, describing something, getting to know something very well. It's an act of intellect. It's an act of intellect. Giving names represents the idea that the mind is at work. Shame represents the one who is the man of great intellect. Chacham, of course, comes from the word hot, yes. A hot-blooded, passionate, and a sensual person. In touch not so much with his mind as with his feelings. Chum is he's the passionate one. He's the hot-blooded one. Is that where what? No. Yefet. The third son, or the oldest, Yefet. The word Yefet, what words do you hear in it? You hear Yofi, of course. Yofi, beauty. In the word Yofi, beauty. In addition to beauty, the word Yefet also means that which spreads out and moves out. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch says that in the word Yefet, we also have the word petty in Hebrew, not petty in English. A pessy. The pessy is usually described as the fool, but he's not really the fool. A pessy is one who is open to the influence of others and is vulnerable. And by being open to influences, I mean, they can be good ones and they can be bad ones. He represents the idea of will, so that shame, and we're going to come back to these definitions because they're going to be important. Shame is the one, is intellect, he's mind. Chum is the sensual one, the one of feeling. Yefet is, say, the one who has a highly developed sense of the aesthetic and the beautiful, Yofi, and he's also open to the influences of the world around him. Shame, of course, is going to be the father of Avraham Avinu. The Jewish people are going to come from shame. Yavon, Greece, is going to come from Yefet. Hirsch also points out something that will become very important in our understanding of the parasha. We always have to learn how to deal with newfangled objects. So just give us time. We'll learn how to use this mic. Okay? You'll let me know by looks on your faces if it's... This is worse. Huh? I'm beginning to think that the... The Jewish people are going to come from shame. Greece is going to come from Yefet. Let's read through the story of the parasha now and try to understand the story. It's a fascinating one, and I believe that it's usually misunderstood. Vayochel Noach Ish Ha'adama. Noach Ish Ha'adama, man of the earth, began. Vayochel means he began. Vayita Koren, and he planted a vineyard. Vayesh Min Hayayin, he drank from the wine. Vayishkor, and he became drunk. Vayidgal B'toch Ohalo, and he became revealed. It would seem naked, B'toch Ohalo, in his tent. Vayar Chom Avi Kenan, Chom, the father of Kenan, saw at Ervat Aviv the nakedness of his father. Vayaged Lishnei Echav Achutz, and he told his two brothers outside. Vayikach Shem Vayefet et Hasimla. Shem and Yefet took the blanket, the garment. Vayosinu al Shem Shneim and placed it on the shoulders of the two of them. Vayelchu Achoranit, and they went backwards. Vayichasu et Ervat Aviyim, and they covered the nakedness of their father. Ufneim Achoranit, and their faces were turned backwards. Ve'ervat Aviyim lo ro'u, they didn't see the nakedness of their father. Why does it say a second time in the pasuk that their faces were backwards? When they begin walking into the tent, they're walking backwards. But when they have to, when they finally come to the father and they have to cover him, they're going to have to turn around in order to get the blanket on him. But as they turn around, they then again turn their head in a different direction, away from the father, so that they shouldn't see his nakedness. And then the pasuk says, "Vayikatz Noach Miyeno." Noach woke up from his wine. Vayeda et Asher Asolo b'Noach Katan, and he knew what his youngest son had done to him, which means it could be either Cham or Canaan. Cham or Canaan. Now, why is Canaan mentioned here? In Pasuk 18 it said, V'chom hu avi Kenan. Chom is the father of Kenan. Chom is going to be the father of many nations, not only of Kenan. Why is Kenan mentioned? And here again, in Pasuk 25, he's going to curse who? Oror Kenan. Cursed is Kenan. Eved avodim yelechov. He shall be a slave of slaves unto his brothers. Where does Canaan fit into all of this? So let's go back first and see the story. Let's see what happened over here. What really happened? Pasuk 20. Vayochel Noach, Ishva Noach. Noach began as a man of the earth. Now, Ish Ha'adama, it does not mean a farmer. If it would have meant farmer, it would have said Ish Adama. Ish Ha'adama means, as Rashi seems to point out, he is really the ruler, the owner of the whole world. He carries upon his shoulders the responsibility for the whole world. The whole world out there is destroyed. No life remains upon the face of this earth. Noah feels his responsibility as Ish Ha'adama, man who is responsible for the whole earth. And he begins the process of renewal, of rebirth. He's going to rebuild the world anew. And he plants a vineyard. Vayesh Min Hayayin. So he drank from the wine by Yishkar, and he became drunk. Well, it could have been something very innocent. According to Hirsch, he drinks from the wine, and for him this is an expression of great joy. What he learns is that the world isn't completely destroyed after the Babel. The earth is still fruitful. The earth is going to be able to give out fruit. There's meaning to the world. The world has its texture and its strength. It's all there. Noah doesn't know what's going to happen when he plants. So he plants.
and he plants a vineyard. And it's good, it's beautiful. He's overcome, according to Hirsch, with a sense of joy. It's a celebration of life. A celebration of life. So in that celebration of life, a little bit too much celebration. You can condemn him, but maybe not condemn him too terribly much. Now, if you read the pasuk carefully, you see that his drinking may very well have been outside. Let's read the pasuk carefully. He drank from the wine. Vayishkar. It seems he begins to sense that he's getting drunk. Vayidgal. Betoch ahalo. It doesn't say that he drank in the tent. It says that it seems that he drank outside, but then when he sees that he's beginning to get high, he goes into the tent in order that he should not be seen by others in this kind of a state of inebriation. By Yidgol, it's betoch ahalo, within his tent. There he is revealed. In other words, he's gone to the privacy of his tent. Vayar Cham Aviknan et Ervat Aviv. Cham saw the nakedness of his father. Cham, who is the father of Canaan. And this, of course, is extremely important. He's the father of many nations. Why is he referred to as the father of Canaan? So here I believe that Shamshon of Pearl Hirsch makes an extremely important comment. Very important comment. And this is part of an ongoing theme of his. As one goes through Torah, say the halachic portions of Torah, there are many psukim that if we would not have Torah Sheba'al Peh, if we would not have the oral law, we would never understand what the pasuk is talking about. And you shall bind them as on your hands and frontlets between your eyes. Tefillin, what are tefillin? What's it all about? What does it mean? There are so many psukim in Torah that simply cannot be understood unless one knows the oral law. Hirsch, at the beginning of Sefer Parshat Shoftim, says the Parshat Mishpatim says the following: for 40 years in the desert, Moshe taught Torah to the Jewish people. He would come down, he would from the mountain, he would tell them the laws, he would explain everything to them. And he says this can be compared to a student who's taking notes, listening to a professor in college, and he's taking notes. And the professor is going to use certain terms, and the professor, of course, will define these terms. The young student who's taking the notes at different places, he'll underline in certain places, he'll put the exclamation marks, and very often the only one who can understand the notes is the student himself. Somebody else is going to try and read those notes. They're not going to make much sense because he doesn't know what the terminology means. He doesn't know the context. But somebody who sat in class will be able to understand. When the teacher used that term, it's right to fully know exactly. It was immediately understood. Torah is given to the Jewish people at the end of 40 years in the desert. They've heard 40 years of shiurim from Moshe, from Aaron, from Elazar, Itamar, Yahushua. They know all of Torah. When they come to a pasuk in Torah, they know me. Ah! You remember what Moshe said when he described to us what tefillin are? You remember how he described to us what a sukkah? The Gemara has a long discussion as to what is pre-Eitz Hadar, the fruit of a beautiful tree, that which is supposed to be taken on Sukkot. Is it this fruit? Is it that fruit? Is it the other fruit? Finally, the Gemara arrives at a conclusion that it's an etrog. Does it mean that until the Gemara was written 2,000 years later, nobody knew what an etrog was? What, they didn't know what they were using? Of course they knew it was an etrog, because Moshe Rabbeinu immediately told it to them. When the generation of the desert came to the pasuk and take to yourself the fruit of a beautiful tree, they knew exactly what it meant. Well, don't you remember? Moshe told us. He didn't tell us an apple. He didn't tell us an orange. He told us an S. What the Gemara is doing is searching for where it really appears in the words. What is it about the Etrog that the Torah describes as a Pri Eitz Hadar? Which means the Torah has to be understood in the context of the people to whom it is being given. In terms of the Halacha, they knew it all. So therefore, what to later generations may have seemed as psukim that are difficult to understand, it could not be understood without the oral law. To them it was clearly understood, because they were told everything in advance. With regard to the stories in Torah, we also have to understand the context. Torah is being given to a people who now stand on the threshold of going into the land of Canaan and conquering that land. The culture that they are going to be coming in contact with now, a degenerate and depraved pagan and heathen culture, whom God says these people must be removed from the land because they have debased themselves and all of humanity. To them, Canaan is an extremely important name. And Torah is being given to them now that this story in Noah is of extreme significance to them, because you know what God is telling them? If you want to understand why Canaan became what he is today, you know how you'll understand it? You have to take a look at the conduct of the elder Zedah. You have to take a look back at all of those generations earlier. The conduct of a father, a Zedah, can have a tremendous positive or negative impact on the child generations later. You're going to come face to face with Canaanite culture, if the word culture can be used about the Canaanites. They were an absolutely evil people. You want to know why? Watch Cham. Cham is the father of Canaan. So we have to look at the psukim in Parashat Noach, right here, that we're learning, as though these are psukim at the end of Devarim, being told by Jews who are standing with flags unfurled, ready for the great thrust into Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe Rabbeinu is telling them, you have to know how a people falls to the level that they've gone. Which means that according to Hirsch, Canaan did not necessarily have to have anything to do with what happened that day in the tent. According to the Medrash and Rashi, Canaan, the son, was involved in the ugliness in the tent. But Hirsch says doesn't have to necessarily be so. It may have been that the fault here was all Chams, all the way Chams. But for the Jews, at the end of 40 years in the desert, it's important to know you're going to take a look at those people in the land of Canaan. You're going to find before yourselves such evil, and you will wonder, where does the evil come from? It all started here. Because take a look at what happens. Look at this puzzle. You know, there are certain psukim that we just read through so quickly, we don't analyze them, we don't see what's happening. Vayar Cham Avi Canaan. Cham, who's the father of Canaan, he saw at Ervat Aviv the nakedness of his father. Ervat Aviv, the Erva of Noah. Now, what's he doing looking? What in heaven's name is he doing looking? Why is he looking into the tent? Second, if he already looks into the tent, what should he have instinctively done? Covered him. But that's not what he does. Vayaged l'shnei echav tachutz, he tells his two brothers outside. So there are two things that are important over here. Bachutz, outside. Do you know what Targum Unkelis says on the word Bachutz? Veshuka, out in the shuk. It's not simply that he's whispering it to his two brothers. He's telling the story to his two brothers out there. You know, Bob is lying around drunk in the tent, and he's all uncovered. But more than that, the word Vayaged, the word Vayaged tells us so much about Klum. Where do we use the word Vayaged? Pesach, the Haggadah. Do you know what Haggadah means? Haggadah means a long, involved, detailed, complete, total story. He's not whispering this to his brothers. They never. The Tata is uncovered. Vayaged, he's enjoying this. He's made a whole story of it. He's telling his brothers outside. You know? Look at Father. Look at Father. Why is he doing this? Why is he doing this? What enjoyment? I don't know if the word is enjoyment. What benefit does Chum get from telling over this story? And it's more than telling over the story. He was looking for it. Vayar Chum, the prophet says that Chum, the father of Canaan, saw because he's looking. If, as we understand the Pesukim, and I believe it's the correct understanding, that Noah has retired to the privacy of his tent so that he should not be seen in this state out there. But he's looking. Vayar, he sees. You know what it means, he sees? He sees that which he is looking for. He wants to find fault with his father. Is it possible that he wants to find fault with his father because everything that his father stands for is something that he's no longer ready to live with? Is it the passionate nature of Chum that he wants to live a life of abandon? He doesn't want the restrictions of an Ish Tzadik Tami Mahoya with a Rotav. He doesn't want to be part of a father, of a family, of a father who et Elokim italeto, who goes with God. Too many restrictions. He wants what he considers the freedom to follow his passions wherever they take them. So what do you have to do? How is he going to be able to live the Chum kind of life? He has to take the tzaddik of the generation and cast him downward. He has to take Noah, his father, and he's going to have to reveal to the whole world, you think that Father Noah is really what he is? It's a myth! And he shatters the myth. He wants to shatter the myth. He's looking for that. And when you look, you know what happens when you look? You find. You find. Does it occur to Chum that, listen, Father was celebrating, yes, the joy of life. Life being reborn. A world starting all over again. So he got a little high. And he did the proper thing. He went into his tent. What are you doing invading Father's privacy? And maybe there's another way to look at it. Could one blame Noah for getting drunk? Do you know what kind of a world Noah is in? Noah is living in a world that has turned into a cemetery. A whole world has been destroyed. And he is a survivor. We in this generation know better than all other generations the syndrome, the guilt of the survivor. Why did I survive? And beneath my very feet, wherever I walk, mankind is buried. Can one blame Noah for getting drunk? Can one blame Noah for an attempt to escape the ugliness of the reality that he's living? A whole world destroyed. No one left. If I let my mind wander a little bit more, is it possible that Noah may be thinking to himself, maybe I could have saved them? Did I do enough? Why didn't I pound on the table before God and say, God, you can't do it. Give them another chance. What did I do for mankind? I went ahead, and for 120 years, I built an ark so that I and my family should survive. And all of mankind, were they really that bad? Was there no other way to resolve the problems of mankind? I can imagine Noah torn and racked with guilt, reliving constantly in his mind, like, why didn't I do something? God spoke to me. God communicated with me. And what happens if I would have defied him and I would have told him, Rabbeinu Shlomo, I'm not building the ark. You want to destroy the world? Noah? Okay. Me too. Like Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu says when God wants to destroy the Jewish people, so God says, you want to destroy the Jewish people? Very good, Malcolm. Erase me from the book that you wrote. He could have bargained, he could have prayed, he could have pleaded, he could have done something. Is it possible that now, after it's all over, so, as we say, he's walking on the graveyard of all of man, of humanity. He's the survivor. Why did he survive? Why didn't he do more for them? None of this means anything to Chum. Chum is the one who's out to look. He wants to find something that's wrong. He wants to find the nakedness of his father. And by the way, interestingly enough, Hirsch says that Ervat Aviv does not have to be understood as indeed his father is absolutely just naked. It's a shanda, it's a harta. The word erva is also used as to mean the weakness of. For example, Yosef tells his brothers, you are spies. You've come to see Ervat Haaretz, the nakedness of the land. So what is this to be understood in sexual terms? No, what it means, Ervat Haaretz, the weakness of the land. Where is it vulnerable? At what point can you invade the land? He sees the weakness. Chum sees the weakness of his father. He's lying there in an undignified way. It doesn't have to mean that he's completely naked. Chum is looking for it. And what's extremely important is, and this is a mistake that people make, Chum was the one who tragically made the mistake first. Children are going to learn kibud av for aim, or the opposite, from their parents. Chum is the one who's creating a monster called Canaan, because Canaan is never going to have respect for his own father or anybody else. The way in which children act to their parents is the way their children are going to act to them as parents. And Chum doesn't realize this. Chum doesn't realize that what he is creating over here is a Canaan who is not going to be receptive to any kind of discipline. Vayikach Shem v'yefet et ha-simla v'yosim al shem shneihem. If we're talking about them now, so let's talk about these two. We know what Chum is. And the type that is Chum is not something that was only in the days of Noach. We know that right now. We know that right now. The idea of shattering myths is, of course, something that we have lived through during the course of the last few years. In other words, those whom we had considered heroes, these are not heroes anymore. I only use this as an example that I think we can relate to. We're in a post-Zionist period, which therefore means that Chana Senesh, you think Chana Senesh was some kind of a heroine? It is a society or a group that feels that they will be able to build themselves up only on the destruction of all that came before. They don't want to live with all that came before. They give them a guilty conscience. No, we're different. All of those who came before The pioneers who came here 100 years ago? Who are you talking about? The ones who died from malaria reclaiming the land? These were colonialists, imperialists, gun-loving, who stole the land from the poor, peaceful inhabitants of the land. You have to shatter all sorts of so-called myths. Unfortunately, tragically, the shattering of myths comes back to haunt the shatterer, because another myth is being shattered, a so-called myth. Invincible Tzahal, Israeli Defense Forces, the shatterers of the myths are shattering their own myth. What Chum is doing is not simply tearing down his father because he can't live with that kind of a father. You know who he's tearing down? He's tearing himself down. He's going to remain a nothing in the eyes of his own children. The Chum, Vayar Chum, who saw? Chum Avi Canaan, the father of Canaan. If you wonder why Canaan becomes what he is, because Canaan has been torn away from his moorings and his roots. Who does he have to look up to now? Not to it. From his father, he's going to learn nothing. And the Zayda Noach has been shattered by his own father. Canaan is therefore going to be the one who inherits the passion, the hot-blooded passion of Chum. With nothing, the chom, yes, the chom, the heat, the passion of Chum, but nothing to channel that passion. The passion of Chum can be channeled in to do great things, to be passionate for great things, for beauty, for ethics, for morality. But once Chum has shattered his father, there are no longer any restraints. No longer any restraints, so Canaan is going to inherit the passion of Chum, but its wild passion of lust and abandon. And that's going to lead to idolatry and paganism. What about the other two? Vayikach Shem v'Yefet et ha-Simla. Shem and Yefet took the Simla, the garment, v'yosimu al shem shneihem, and they placed it on the shoulders of the two of them. Rashi here is very beautiful. Rashi is always beautiful. I take that back. Rashi is always beautiful. Rashi says the following. In Ktiv v'yikhu, it doesn't say they took. Shouldn't it have been a plural? It's Shem and Yefet. Doesn't say vayikru, it says vayikach. Ain't nah. Limei, this comes to teach us that the one who initiated the covering of the father was Shem. And Yefet is the one who joins him. The one whose idea it is and the one who instinctively moves to cover the father is Shem. Yefet comes along. Vayikach Limei, this comes to teach us how Shem shenit amedz ban mitzvah yoter miYefet. Shem is the one who put in the effort to do this mitzvah more than Yefet. Lakach zochu banav, therefore, the Gemara says, do you know what the reward of Shem was? That his children were rewarded with the mitzvah of a talus that has tzitzis, a garment of tzitzis. What was the reward that was given to the children of Yefet? The reward to the children of Yefet. Wait a minute. The reward to the children of Yefet. Oh, this is going to be a surprise. Gog and Magog are going to be the descendants of Yefet. Gog and Magog, if you remember the Haftorah of Shabbos Chol Hamoed Sukkos, the Haftorah is the story of Gog and Magog coming against Yerushalayim to destroy Yerushalayim. And they're going to be defeated on the mountaintops of Eretz Yisrael. There's going to be an awesome and a frightening defeat. God is going to wage war against the forces of evil. A world that's going to want to move in on Yerushalayim. It gives me the shiver runs down my spine. You know what the reward is? I didn't even say what the reward is. You know what the reward is? That after the forces of Gog and Magog, who are the children of Gezer, if they're going to be utterly and completely destroyed, they're going to be buried.
Buried.
They're going to be Zocha Lekvura. Burial. You understand? It's a big mitzvah to bury Yogasha. This is what's going to be. In other words, what happens over here is the following. They cover their father. So therefore they both receive the blessing of covering. One's covering is going to be a covering of mitzvah, and the other's covering is going to be at the end of history, they are going to be buried beneath the sands of Eretz Yisrael. Well, we have to understand what's the difference between shame and yefet. And here I'm going to take you on a bit of a journey, and as usual, I'm always afraid that I'm certain that I'm not going to do it justice. Rav Soloveitchik in two places speaks about shame and yefet. In one place, in the Nefesh HaRav, he quotes the Rav as having said the following: the difference between shame and yefet was the difference between ethics and etiquette. What's the difference between ethics and etiquette? Ethics is something that comes from within the consciousness of a human being, a moral position of what's right and what's wrong. An ethical position is one that makes absolutely no difference whether anybody is present or one isn't present. What comes out of the neshama is something that a person has to do because it's right. Shame was a man of ethics, a man of principle, a man of morality. He hears about the nakedness of his father, his instinct. There's nobody around. I mean, it's all in the family. But no, he's going to go and cover his father. What's etiquette? Etiquette is also the right thing to do. But it's all superficial. It's all external. And by the way, it changes from generation to generation. I mean, 2 centuries ago, it was etiquette, I imagine, to eat with one's hands. Until man developed, over the last 200 years, I mean, I was just reading an article, I think it was in Haaretz, about the development of the fork. What a story. That fork that we take for granted, there were minds who worked for generations until they came up with the four-pronged fork. For about 300-400 years, man used a two-pronged. Good, that's why I need your help. Fork. And it seems that pieces of meat kept falling between the fork and his mouth. So man decided, I mean, some guy in some place who patented it, I don't know, in Upper Silesia, he made a third tooth. Can I use that? The prong? Tongue! To the fork. And it seems still pieces kept falling until somebody, genius, great genius, most probably even more important than the electric light bulb, the incandescent lamp, came up with four somethings to the fork. Four doodads to make up the fork. All right. It means that there was history before the fork. And there must have been an etiquette of how you eat without a fork, then how you eat with a fork. And then, of course, there's the question, when you set the table, where do you put the knife and where do you put the fork? Right-hand side, left-hand side, small spoon, big spoon. Etiquette is something, first of all, that's external. Number two, it can be ever-changing. What was acceptable, maybe a generation ago, it's not acceptable today, and then we'll probably have so many different areas in which we're not even aware of it ourselves. We'll stop and think about things that we may do or not do today that we would not have done or would have done 25 or 30 years ago. It's all external. And you know what it depends on? It depends upon the presence of others. Yefet will only act to join Shem. because there is Hashem who is going to cover his father. So that means Shem has established the principle that it's the right thing to do. So therefore, he is going to join with Yefet, with Shem. He would not do it on his own. So Shem is the man of ethics, the man of morality, the one who has an inner compass that tells him what's right and what's wrong. Yefet, it's all external. Like the Yofi, a great deal of Yofi, beauty, is external. You wipe away the beauty and what's hidden behind the beauty. And this brings me to a second major essay of the Rav. And here, I'll try my best. The Medrash says, he bases it all on a Medrash. The Medrash says, Arurim harushoyim. The evil should be cursed. Shekol makom shehem nosim edeinayim, wherever they lift their eyes, eino elo l'ra. They lift their eyes, they look, it's only for bad. And he brings two psukim. One is, Vatisa eshet adonav edeineha el Yosef. The wife of his master lifted her eyes toward Yosef. Vatomer, and she said, Shichvo imi, lie with me. She's looking. And she creates the opportunity where she should be alone in the house with Yosef. She lifts her eyes, and the raising and the lifting and the looking is all for evil. The second pasuk is, you guessed it, Vayar Chom Avi Kenan. Chom, the father of Kenan, saw at Ervat Aviv the nakedness of his father, and he told his two brothers. But there is another lifting of the eyes. The tzaddik who lifts his eyes, he lifts it for blessing. Kol makom sheroim, wherever they look, you know what they see? They see good. Shenema, as it says, when Avraham on the third day is going toward the Akedah, Vayom Ashlishi, Vayisa Avraham, es Enoch, Avraham lifts his eyes, Vayar et hamakom merachok, and he saw the place so far. He was the one who was able to sense that mountain, Har Habayit, that's the place. He felt the Kedusha. He saw the divine presence over the mountain. And then, another interesting pasuk. Yaakov flees from his father's house before the wrath of Esav. He comes out there all alone to Padan Aram, Fayar, and he saw the Hinei Be'er Basadeh. There is a well in the field, and there are three groups of shepherds with their flocks around the well. No, that's what he sees. What should he have done? What are you people doing here so early in the day? No. He hears that it's a heavy stone, so he says, Achai, my brothers, come. Let's work together. He doesn't condemn, he doesn't accuse, he doesn't attack. And then finally, for the well-being of all, he goes and he removes the stone from the well. Wherever a tzaddik or the good look, they see and they create good. Where the Rasha lifts his eyes, there is evil. It may also mean the following. Two people can see the same thing. Let's take Chom and Shem. Chom and Shem saw two different things. Because Chom wanted to see something terrible in his father. Shem most probably never, not for a moment, did he condemn his father, reject his father, attack his father. What do you want? What do you want from a man who has to rebuild a whole world? What do you want? So he got a little home. No. Let him enjoy it. Gesundheit. What a father we have. Man chosen from an entire world by God to be the one to be saved and rebuild the world. He sees, Shane sees, Ish, Tzadik, Tommy, Hoyobidorotam, he sees a great Noah. Not Chom, Chom doesn't see that. Which means the following. The Rav says, the great test of the Jew, is when he is faced with the phenomenon of beauty in the world. Beauty, majesty, grandeur, radiance. that's where the Jew is tested, whether he has the ability to see and see clearly. Does he know what to look at and how to assess and evaluate it? Is he the grandson of Avram Avinu, who by Yis Avram at Enov, Avram lifts his eyes and he sees the divine presence? Or does he see something else? Man by nature is drawn to beauty. Colors, flowers, symmetric objects that are form, a beautiful sunrise, a beautiful sunset. We feel good, and the Gemara says it, Shlosha Devarim Marchivin Dako Shaladam, there are three things that broaden a person's outlook. Isha Noah, a beautiful, pretty wife. Dira Noah, nice apartment. Kalim Noah, nice furniture. You know, after Yontif, after grandchildren have gone, and finally clean up the house, you spend hours removing the blessed dirt that's caked into the floors, and all of a sudden it's quiet and it's clean and everything is in its proper place. There's a certain sense of well-being. We feel good. We respond in a very positive way to beauty. And the fact is that Torah does indeed appreciate beauty. Torah places value on beauty. What's the classic? Zekeli v'anveyu. This is my God and I will make him beautiful. Hitna elefanav b'mitzvot. Let mitzvot be beautiful. A beautiful Sefer Torah. A beautiful hidur mitzvot. That mitzvah should be done with beauty. This morning, it's Rosh Chodesh in the morning, so we say Baruch Nafshi. Baruch Nafshi at Hashem. My soul blesses God. Gadol Tamiyod, how great you are. Hod v'hodar lavashta, you have donned majesty and splendor. Ote or kasalma, you are cloaked in light like a garment. Note shamayim kayediyah, stretching out the heavens like a curtain. In other words, we see the beauty of nature as a beautiful curtain, a beautiful garment. Beauty is something that Torah appreciates. Torah appreciates it. However, Torah also says that one has to be very, very careful. One has to be able to look at beauty and be able to discern, is the beauty real? Is it more than skin deep? Or is this beauty no more than a facade, a veneer? It's beauty plated. It's a cover for what can be the worst ugliness hiding behind it. Beauty can also be that which conceals and camouflages ugliness, cruelty, bestiality. In Tanakh, when they described the places where idolatry was worshipped, it was always within the bosom of the beauty of nature, upon the hills and the mountains and the trees. And you know why it was done there? In order to conceal the ugliness and the promiscuity of the manner of worship before idolatry. It was done where there were a lot of trees in order that one shouldn't hear the cries of human beings who were brought to sacrifices before the idols. How many stories are there of Jews who were taken to their deaths to the strain of Beethoven and Wagner? Beauty can be that which is truly beautiful, or it can be the worst kind of camouflage before ugliness. Jew has to be able to differentiate between the two. Are we going to fall victim to the enchantment, the blinding enchantment of all sorts of cultures around us? And Jews, unfortunately, did very often fall victim. And if we didn't fall victim, we were the ones who may very well have created it. 70 years ago, Jews were proclaiming communism as the great, as that which was going to solve all of the world's problems. So we were zeichen in our lifetime to find out that all of that was meaningless. It was a veneer. Language was used about the equality of all of mankind. All of the great terms that we 10 chance for communism. I imagine somebody must have said, "Give communism a chance." I can hear them. I can hear them saying it. Yeah. Communism 1 and communism 2. Lenin and Stalin. Yeah. Until you find out that it was all absolute ugliness. I can't. If one would study the last 50 years of history, there is so much so-called beauty that has turned into, or we found out, was absolute ugliness. There is a parasha in Torah that says, when you're going to go out to war against your enemy, and in war you're going to see a very beautiful woman, and you're going to bring her home with you. So the halacha says that first of all, bilchet rosha, she is supposed to cut off her hair, cut her nails, remove the garments of captivity, and then wait. Let's see what she's going to look like afterwards. Have you been enchanted by the beauty of this woman now, and really there is no beauty behind it all? There's only ugliness. Says the Rav, when the Torah talks of a beautiful woman that's brought home from war, the Torah is also talking symbolically of foreign cultures that you're going to be captivated by or bring home captive to you. We don't have to elaborate on anything that's American. Anything that's American is something that is worshipped in this country, except, of course, the American accent of the right-wing extremist nuts who are fighting for this country because they love it. Everything else American is good. If only they would drop all the other American nonsense and accept the American Abbas, Eretz Yisrael, why would this be a better place? All of the facade and the veneer, that which really conceals and camouflages absolute ugliness. Empty to the very core. Empty to the very core. One can even, there's even a social aspect to, or historic aspect to what the Rav says. The Rav, obviously when he said it at his time, and there was a time like that, and I think it's even true in some place in the United States today, there were parents that sent their children to public school and not to the local yeshiva, because the local yeshiva was usually in a run-down building. Understand? That the paint was peeling from the walls, but they were teaching Torah within those ugly walls. So where did they send their children? To the beautiful, beautiful public school down the block, where they were teaching ugliness within. The test of the Jew is, what does he see? The survival of the Jewish people has been dependent upon one thing. We were always able to see beauty and hope, even at the worst moments in our history. If we would not have been able to see beyond the present, we would never have survived. And every civilization that saw only the present disappeared from the face of this earth. We were able, like Rabbi Akiva, to stand in the midst of destruction and see hope. In the midst of ruin, see rebuilding. Depends what you see. Those who come with Avram, Eliezer and Yishmael, who come with Avram to Har HaMoriah, see a mountain. And not terribly an impressive mountain as that. I'm sure as far as they are concerned, what are you talking about? The Hermon, that's a mountain. Har HaBayit, what's Har HaBayit? I don't know, did Yishmael already begin to think then that he's going to lay claim to the Har HaBayit? Avram is the one who is able to see beyond the superficial. Beyond the superficial. There's a beautiful line of poetry by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi that I think will bring us really to what we want to say. The difference between shame and Yetzer. Shame is Avram. Avram is going to come from shame. Yetzer is Greece. The fact is, in this, dare not be forgotten. All of the good that the Western world has, or for that matter, world civilization, came from two sources: from Judaism and from Greece. There were a few hundred years during which Greek culture and Greek learning and Greek intellect captured and captivated the world. It was 2,500 years ago. Since then, it's only been Anthony Quinn. 2,500 years. Nothing else. Greece hasn't meant a thing. Hasn't meant a thing. After the period of the great philosophers, it was all over for Greece. And then Rabbi Yehuda Halevi points this out in the Sefer HaKuzri. But those few hundred years, the beauty and the ethics and the morality, the thought processes that were brought by the Greek world, and yes, the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and Rav Sadia Goyen, the great Jewish minds, were able to adopt and incorporate and deal with that Greek greatness. But it disappeared from the world. But it left its impact. The beauty of Greece, Yefet, and shame are the two fundamental pillars upon which a whole world of thought stands. But Rav Yehuda Halevi writes so beautifully, I'll say it in Hebrew, and I will translate it. He writes in one of his poems, Va'al tashiacha chochmat yevanit, do not be seduced by Greek wisdom, asher ein lo pri ki im prachim, it has no fruit, only flowers. It has no fruit, only flowers. What a powerful, powerful sentence. It's beautiful. Huh? You want to know where it is? I'll say it. I love it. I'll say it again. Va'al tashiacha. Tashiacha from seduction. And last week said, Hanochosh hishiani. The woman said, it was the nochosh hishiani. He seduced me so that I... Va'al tashiacha chokhmat yevanit asher ein la pri ki im prachim. The difference between shame and yefet. Shame is able to see what real beauty is. He knows how to deal with beauty. He is not seduced by beauty. But unfortunately, there are times that the beauty of Delilah overcomes even the Shimshon. It says that the Ashnehu al Birkeha, she put him to sleep upon her lap. And then they cut off the locks of Shimshon's hair. And she tells him, Plishtim alecho, the Plishtim have come. And he wants to get up again with all of his strength as before, but he doesn't know that his strength is gone. His strength is gone. He's given his strength away. He's abandoned it to the seduction of a Delilah. Avraham Avinu is not impressed by a facade. Avraham Avinu is the one who is looking deeper beyond the superficial. The difference between Chum and, on the one hand, and Shem and Yafet. Chum is the one who's looking for ugliness, and he finds what he thinks to be ugliness. By the way, what he thinks to be ugliness. Nobody is justifying Noah, but it wasn't a terrible thing. But who did he hurt? Who did he hurt? And what if he is indeed depressed, as one approach would put it, or the celebration of life, as the other approach would put it? But Chum is looking for ugliness. He finds it. Yefet and shame are also different. Yefet remains with the beauty without the content. And therefore, that beauty can fade away. Avraham Avinu, the difference between Avraham Avinu, who comes from Shem, and this is another idea that the that the rug develops, that we may have to spend time at some other occasion to talk about it. Avraham Avinu, in his search for beauty, knows that this is a job that he cannot undertake alone. He needs somebody else. After the Akedah, Vayelchu, Shneim Yachdov, they both go together. The beauty that he sees in the world is people, Jews, working together for the greater glory of Klal Yisrael. Yefet is the beauty that he sees and the beauty that he looks for is a beauty that can, well, I'm reminded of a song, if one rose grows alone in your garden, its sweet fragrance shall soon pass away. That's a Victor Herbert. Shame is the one who sees real beauty, and it is Yefet who is who follows him, because Yefet is not really the one who fully appreciates what real, genuine beauty is. I'll just end with one beautiful halacha. Beautiful halacha. A halacha, we're talking about an esrog is supposed to be beautiful, right? So there are all sorts of colors that are acceptable, and there are colors that are unacceptable. An esrog has to be yellow, yellowish, green, tending toward yellow. Black is no good. A black esrog. What about brown? What about brown? So the Chazon Ish, some sofa, says that if at the beginning of Sukkot, you know, coming off of the tree, it's brown, the esrog is possible. But what happens if during the course of Yom Tov, you know, a person is holding the esrog in his hand, and maybe a few people also hold it and make a brach on it, it begins to develop brown spots. The Chatam Sofer says that's kosher. Why is that brown kosher? Because that brown represents the loving hands of Jews who are fulfilling a mitzvah. And there's nothing more beautiful than that. It means that not only is the difference between shame and yafet that one appreciates real beauty and the other is intoxicated by something that's superficial and outer beauty, it's more than that. Shame has a different definition of beauty. What's beautiful to Shem is something that Yefet could never appreciate. Just as that mountain that Avram sees, not such a special mountain, but he appreciates it because he appreciates the inner beauty that it has in it. There's so much more to be said on these two psukim, but what's most important, therefore, is the following. What happens over here, and what Noah says over here, regardless of what date you're going to give to the appearance of Torah, one thing is certain. Noah here establishes that there are going to be two forces in the world, shame and yefet. And whichever approach you take, he said it 2,000 years before shame and yefet appeared on the face of this earth. We, 2,000 years later, can see that everything that Noach says over here, absolutely true. Shame and Yefet became the fundamental pillars of an entire world. Noach saw so clearly and so prophetically what was going to happen in history. Saw it so clearly, and that it's true, and therefore he curses Cham and Canaan that they should be enslaved. And you know what it means to be enslaved? Not that he's saying they should be slaves. He's saying that this Chum's personality is a personality that's going to enslave him. His personality is such, his passion is going to be open to all sorts of influences. He's a hakeif de mensch. He's a person who is mishubad. He's not a free person. Shem and Yefet, on the other hand, Yaftalakim Yefet, yes, God, give beauty to Yefet. But you know where God is going to dwell? The Yishkon Ba'alei Shem. The only place where he's going to dwell, the only place where the divine presence can rest, is in the tent of Shem. Because Shem sees far beyond the superficial. Sees real, real beauty. Appreciates real beauty. And has to learn never to be seduced by the facade or the veneer of beauty out there in the world that usually camouflages ugliness and cruelty.